All right. Thanks, everybody. Another edition of Conversations with Dr. Cowan and Friends. And some of the new friends are friends that I'm actually just meeting now, which is even more fun because I think then I get to have more friends than I used to. And I didn't know much about our this new guest. His name is Christopher Gardner. He's coming to us from Costa Rica. And all I can say is the little I know, I am actually fascinated by what I'm about to learn in the next hour. The reason is, like when I see myself versus some of the people I know, and I think Christopher, like I know about Victor Schauberger, and I can spout out that Victor Schauberger says that if you cut down the trees over a stream, you know, then the fish, the trout spend the rest of their life in useless toil, swimming up the stream. So that's my life, is I know those sort of things, but I think Christopher knows how to put that into action. I think, therefore, Christopher is probably a lot more valuable than I am. That's my conclusion. Although maybe I have some value in getting people to hear what Christopher is doing. But that's really the goal here, is to find out, Christopher, what you're doing and how people can learn more and even do more things. And with that brief introduction, welcome. And just tell us a little bit how you got into what you're doing, and we'll take it from there.
Well, I moved to Costa Rica at the end of 2006, and I bit off way more than I could chew. I with a bunch of partners, we got signal to bolt from the States and live a more natural lifestyle where we could grow our own food and live a much simpler life. And we ended up buying near 100 acres in the jungle, and there's a little problem with buying 100 acres in the jungle.
What was the impetus for getting you to leave? Was it anything specific or just fed up?
Well, there was a bunch of things. I was traveling to India every year during the winter time, and every time I would come back from India, I felt less congruent with the materialism of South Florida. Like where I was living in South Florida, like there's nothing really to do there other than to shop. Like everything is about consumerism.
Yeah.
And so every year I'd come back from India, I just didn't feel like this was, it didn't feel right to me. Like yeah. I didn't fit. And one morning, because I had just gotten back from India and it was like 3 a.m. in the morning, and I just decided to go for a walk in my neighborhood. You know, it was beautiful night out. It was like, you know, nice and chilly. So I went on this walk and these two cop cars pulled up right next to me. And this was like 2005. I mean, this was a long time ago. And these cops were bullying me and treating me like I was a criminal. And they were asking me what I was doing and where my ID was. And I was like, I'm just walking in my neighborhood. Like, and they're like, oh, we got calls that there was somebody suspicious. And I go, am I breaking the law in any way? And I just felt like I didn't fit there anymore.
Got it.
And so a bunch of us that had pulled together some resources, we mulled over Thailand, we mulled over Australia and Costa Rica, and Costa Rica made the most sense because it was close. And it was relatively inexpensive. So we just pulled our resources together and we bit off more than we could chew. And we bought this massive property. And then I, like in a dumbfounded moment on the plane, I was describing what I had just done to the guy that was sitting next to me. And he goes, oh, so you're a developer. And I go, I'm not a developer. And he goes, son, you just bought 100 acres in the jungle. You're running roads and electric. He goes, you're a developer. And I was like scared to death. And at the very same time.
How old were you at the time?
I was 29. It was right during my Saturn return. So All right. A lot of people move here during their Saturn return. It's kind of funny. So at the very same time, I was given a book from the author Callum Coates called Living Energies. And it was basically this exposition on the life of Victor Schauberger and all of his works. And I read that book front to back 4 times before I even got to Costa Rica.
Yeah.
And it like completely, I was like, his 100 questions for science, like to this day, are the best questions I've ever heard. And yeah. I think he devised those questions in, you know, the 1920s. And it blew my mind. Everything that he was talking about with water management, I had seen the exact opposite in South Florida, because where I grew up, you know, the Army Corps of Engineers, they would make a straight canal for 10 miles.
Yeah.
You know, there, everything was walled off. And I saw every year the decline in the fish. I saw the runoff from back then. Nobody knew about glyphosate, like, you know, as they say it now. But it was very obvious, like near, you never ate the fish that were near any of the golf courses. Like I saw all the things that he talked about in his book. Like he said, if you do this, then this will occur. And I got to see that where I grew up, but in retrospect.
Yeah.
So I instantly was like, oh my goodness, we have a chance to do it right. We have a chance to use nature as teacher and like actually watch the systems, and whatever we add will be additive. It won't take away from the environment here.
Right. Just to let everybody know, Victor Schauberger was also called the Water Wizard, and he's been a big inspiration in my life. And I won't get into a lot of it, but one of his famous quotes was, there's more stored energy in a drop of water than in any power plant on Earth.
And I totally agree. And what was really neat too was I was able to go to areas in Costa Rica where they had been relatively untouched, and I got to see a trout jumping up a waterfall.
Yeah.
Like that was one of his big things, like the vortexes that the eddy currents make in the waterfalls, and, you know, the negative ionization. And I actually saw it. So I already trusted him on a mental level, but then to actually see it. And then I think it was early 2007 when the rainy season had just started here. I woke up, I was living at about 2000 feet of elevation. And I was looking down at the valley beneath me, which was all forest, all rainforest. And I could actually see, he talks about when trees are very alive and in the ground is alive, the trees will discharge plasma. They'll discharge light. And I saw it. Because it actually woke me up. I saw what I thought was lightning. I saw this pulsing light. So when I actually got up and walked on the porch and looked down in the valley, I could actually see like little fireflies down in the valley. I got to see these charges of light being discharged. And I was like, man, this guy knew exactly what he was talking about.
Yeah. All right. So how do you go about putting these ideas of vortexes and implosion and the creation of energy without any kind of burning? How do you make that into like devices or things that actually people can use?
Well, it's really kind of cool. Like when you start to get into hydrogen science, I ended up teaming up with an inventor that made something that was a derivation of the Joule cell. Have you ever heard of the Joule cell?
No.
So Joule cell is, it's like, it, the best way to say it's an electrolyzer of water. So, but without making the water, dividing the water through amps, you actually send a frequency through water through different cylinders that actually causes the water to disassociate in a very specific way. So yeah. You're not like burning the water. You're actually like, you know, I guess the best way to say is you're sending a baby time. You're sending a harmonic through the water that lets it resonate, and it releases something called Brown's gas, which is like a form of protium, which is light hydrogen. Yeah. Well, what occurs is you can collect that, and when you light it, it implodes. And so if you've ever heard an implosion, it actually sucks your eardrum out. So in 2008, I ran into this inventor and I bought his invention because I loved his, he was a Victor Schauberger fan, and the whole goal was to be able to run combustion engines on water. And so I thought that was a great way to kind of get my foot in the door with the environmental science people down here. And so I bought one of his devices on a whim, and it worked. Like, it actually created this milky white substance that when you would light it, it would suck everything into it. It would pull everything to the center, and it has a totally different sensation, a totally different waveform on your ear. So for about a year, we were installing these in cars and trying to get them to work, but it's crazy. The second a car starts to be efficient, the computer system on the car tells the car to run with more gas. Like, they call it running lean. Or when the temperature drops. So I got to see firsthand that what Victor Schauberger was saying is true. When you have something that's imploding, one, it cools down. Two, it's self-lubricating. And three, it takes a lot less energy because there's no heat loss. But what was crazy was all the computer systems for modern generators and modern motors, it's very hard to get past that type of electronic management.
Yeah.
So I kind of let it go. So after that point, I was like, well, what can I do where I'm not reliant on somebody else's contraption? And Victor Schauberger was really big into the egg shape. He really believed, like, he would make these water tanks where water would flow in and it would spiral, and he would create these vessels that had no angles of sorrow. So the water would actually, as the water was entering, it would vortex. And he always likened his water vessels to what he called the cosmic egg. And the way you could think of the cosmic egg is if you were to take the Vitruvian Man and spin him on an axis, you would actually get a five-pointed pentagon. If you spin that, and then I forget whether it's the golden mean or the golden section, connect the ends, you have a perfect egg shape.
Right. Yeah.
And in that, and I've done this because I build domes. I got into building domes because of that. I was like, I had been in some geodesic domes before, and I really liked the idea of dome construction because I got to see, when I first moved to Costa Rica, it was the first time I ever experienced earthquakes. In Florida, we didn't have any earthquakes, but here we get a lot of earthquakes. And so one of the things that they talk about with a dome is it's monolithic. And so it's egg theory. So I had all this in my mind. I was like, okay, Schauberger eggs. Eggs are the best way to hold water. If you take half of an egg, that's a dome. That can survive earthquakes. So I just went into dome building.
And so at that point, did you have a house on this 100 acres, or you had nowhere to live?
No, we lost all of our money in the development. And that's why that's another reason why I got into dome building was all my money went into the development, and then I was renting another place that was actually in civilization. And a friend of mine gifted me a book called The Hand Sculpted House. And so they were talking about how you can essentially mold your house into organic shapes. And I looked at that and I was like, oh my God, because I've always loved domes ever since my time in Florida, because I think it was 1991 when Hurricane Andrew hit. My dad built skyscrapers. Like, my dad was an engineer architect that built these big, big buildings. And he was always telling me the benefit of these domes, because, you know, when the wind shear would happen, these domes have perfect shear strength.
Yeah.
And anybody that has lived in through a hurricane, you know that, that you really want that. But here in Costa Rica, what's more beneficial about the domes is that when the earth, when the ground has liquefaction, like when the ground shakes a lot, the dome itself won't sink into the ground. If you have a post and beam structure, that will actually sink into the ground. So I was like, oh, this is the best of all worlds here. Like, not only is it resilient towards wind, it's resilient towards earthquakes.
Got it. So at that point then, how did you go from knowing this? Did you start building domes and did you start building water devices?
I was drawing my dream house, and a friend of mine looked at my drawings. I could always draw really well. And he's like, that's the exact house that I want. And I said, well, send me to school and I'll build it for you. And so he did. He sent me to Cal Earth University, where I learned, I got certified in earth bag dome construction. And I used his house that we ended up building in 2008 as my practicum.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. And that's a half egg shaped house.
Yeah. So there's two essential shapes to domes. There's the one that looks like a beehive. You know, they call it a lancet arch dome.
Yeah.
And then you have your hemispherical dome.
Right.
So an egg is just a lancet arch dome with a hemisphere at the bottom.
Got it.
So I've learned how to build both. Like I learned the lancet arch creation, because you can build with earth that way. That isn't really appropriate for the tropics, because there's no need for all of that mass in a building in the tropics in a temperate area. But areas like the desert or areas that get really cold or really hot, that's a much more appropriate way to build a dome. Here, I've gone towards the Japanese star dome design, which is a really cool way. It's like, I call it the 21st century way of doing a geodesic dome. But the cool thing about these star domes is that they're always under tension. You use single members and you bend them into place. And once you bend them into place, then you fix them into place. And once that's there like that, the building is always under dynamic tension. So
these are wood frames that you mold, essentially?
No. Well, I've done them in bamboo. Actually, the very first one that I actually have on my property, I took 10 meter long bamboo. So it's like 34 feet long bamboo. Uh-huh. And then I split them. So you ended up having ribs. I tied them together and then bent them into place. And that was my very, very first star dome. But now when I'm building for clients, I build them out of steel.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. And there's been a really cool sidebar with that, is that I found the second one that I was building, I had a client that was extremely EMF sensitive. And so I had been looking into Faraday cages forever, like, because I'm somewhat EMF sensitive. And I was like looking at the star dome, because it's all these ribs of metal. It's essentially, if you're to take a pentagon, what do they call it? It's actually a pentagram inside of a pentagon instead of a pentagram inside of a pentagon. And you make a mandala of that on the ground, and then you pop it under tension into the dome, right?
Yeah.
And I was looking at that and I'm like, that's just a big asymmetric Faraday cage. So what I did then was, in the stem walls, I ran wire in the stem walls, and the stem walls were made of earth, and that makes an earthen battery. And so what it ended up happening is once we cemented everything into place, we ran the EMF meters, because everything was grounded, and to see if you get any cell signal in or out. And anywhere that you were inside the wall, you couldn't get a cell signal. But as soon as you went towards a window opening or a door opening, you could get a signal. Uh-huh. So it completely works. So my whole thing is now, with a bunch of my clients that are sensitive like that, I'm always saying that we should do I call it an asymmetric Faraday cage.
Yeah.
To help shield them.
Okay, so you get into building, and then what? Where did you go with the water? You talked about water purification or enlivening water.
So with water storage, part of the whole fun with the building the dome is you end up with these vessels that look like eggs. So I was like, let's go ahead and store some water in it and also use flow forms as the way that we actually get the water into these vessels. So I started building all these different types of spiral flow forms, because the way I look at what I do is I'm just a sculptor. I'm sculpting with the medium of cement, or I'm sculpting with the medium of a cob. And so water loves the flow form of anything that creates a spiral eddy current in it.
Yeah.
And when you do that, it enlivens the water. By now the science is saying what it does is, and I don't think this is the only thing that it does, but for the more, I guess you would call it, rigid scientists, they say that what that does is it allows for more protium for the water to become lighter. And protium is just, it's hydrogen. It's a hydrogen atom with no, I'm going to massacre it. Whatever it is, the substantive aspect of it is whenever it comes in contact with biological entities, they grow better, they feel better, everything right. Just works better. And so I started doing that. And then I also got into a bunch of work with Dr. Floyd Sweet around magnetic conditioning of water. And that's been graduated into Kenneth Wheeler's work around conditioning water with, he has very specific terms with magnetics, and I don't want to butcher any of them, but my wife is a wonderful example. She grew up in South Florida also, and anybody who grows up in South Florida doesn't drink water because the water is gross.
Right.
And so you build a habit of never drinking water. And so the tail of the tape is I condition the water here, and my wife actually is hydrated. She loves drinking the water here. And there's such a huge difference from the water, because we have relatively clean springs here, but there's still, you know, pollution intrusion from all different things. The water that I condition relative to the water that I don't condition, it's night and day.
So let's go through the process here. So you take water from a spring. Is that the source water?
Yes.
And so what happens next? You funnel it into something from there. What take us through the whole process?
Yeah, that goes to an egg-shaped tank. Then the water from the egg-shaped tank comes to mine.
So from the spring right into an egg-shaped tank.
Right.
And then what's the egg-shaped tank made out of?
Ferrocement.
What?
Ferrocement.
Ah, okay.
So ferrocement is awesome. What it is, it's concrete that has very, very little aggregate in it.
Got it.
So once again, you imagine a Faraday cage that looks like an egg, where you put like just a thin shell, like a 2-inch shell of magnesium concrete in it.
Yeah.
So the water comes in at an angle and then it spins. It gains the volume it needs, and then it drops. It's gravity fed through a line that I always buy what's called a PEX line. It's a polyethylene based pipe that doesn't leach anything into the water. So that water then comes down, that's master feeds my house. But then that goes through a 55-gallon drum that I have full of biochar. So the biochar is the second aspect. Biochar is just pyrolyzed carbon. Pyrolyzation just means that you cook biomass without oxygen. And I figured out a way to do that on just a very small scale. Because I make lots of different types of ovens here, and I just figured out how to convert one of them that every time I would cook food, I could also make biochar. And I have those videos on YouTube.
Got it. So basically biochar is is a slow burn, so you're excluding any air essentially from.
It's not slow at all. Not slow. It's actually, I can convert 33 gallons by volume of biomass in 20 minutes into its carbon, into solely its carbon footprint.
Got it. Okay, so it's basically, it's sort of like charcoal, but better.
It's much better than charcoal, yeah, because charcoal, what occurs is charcoal has oxidative stress because it's exposed to oxygen.
Got it.
So the oxygen creates a different reaction. What occurs is when you make I call it a rocket retort, that's the vessel in which you cook your biomass. Whenever you heat something up, the easiest way to think of it is like a pressure cooker. There becomes a positive pressure gradient inside the vessel that causes an expansion that excludes the outside environment.
Yeah.
So what I'll do is I'll take this vessel, I'll cook my biomass, and then that biomass very quickly releases its volatiles. So it releases its methane, its carbon monoxide, all these things that want to burn. And then I just funnel all those volatiles back to where the fire is, which makes the fire hotter, which makes everything, like it ramps up the actual conversion very, very fast.
And so instead of burning with oxygen, you're burning with methane and all these things from the biomass.
Yeah, and also I have oxygen that's entering the system only on the front side, but that oxygen never touches the biomass.
Got it. So then you get this stuff. It looks like fine charcoal in a sense, right?
It's fine. And all I ever do is I either use leaves or wood shavings.
Got it.
And so because I'm always building and I'm always in all these mills, like every time I go to a mill to buy wood or I'm on my property cutting wood, I just push all the shavings to the side, make sure that they're dry. And then every time I'm going to cook, I just throw all those shavings inside my rocket retort. Like yesterday I made kombucha, right? So I had to cook all this water. I had to heat water. Heating water is a huge energy suck. So I just used my machine to do that. But in the 20 minutes it took to heat all my water and make my tea, I made my biochar.
Got it. So then you fill this 55-gallon drum, right, with biochar.
Well, I fill a 33-gallon drum and I place that inside. I can't wait for you to see the YouTube or the Instagram because I have it all documented on there. But you fill a 33-gallon drum and you place that in the middle of the 55-gallon, and the 55-gallon drum is only acting as a heat guide. So the fire is rifling inside that and it's going all the way around the 33-gallon drum, which is the retort.
Got it. Okay, so you make the biochar and then in the water, so it's coming out of the tank and it's going down and then it goes into this biochar drum.
Right. And then there's enough volume and enough head on the water where it passes through. And then that then enters, you know, then at that point it enters my, what's it called when you have multiple valves? I always forget my plumbing terminology. That enters essentially the main valving for my house.
Got it.
And then where we drink water, that's where I have the secondary magnetic conditioner. So the biochar
function is to essentially scrub any sort of toxic residue that might be in the water.
Exactly. Yeah. It's highly polarized negative. So whatever positively charged entity is in the water gets completely neutralized.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. So now I've got clean water that was swirling around in a vortex. So it's essentially picked up that sort of implosion energy, mm-hmm. and that's coming out, and then it goes into what's the next step?
So now then I have it in a secondary water vessel, and then in that water vessel, I have a very slow vortex where it goes through. I have, I think, a series of six 80,000 gauze magnets. And then I have the water spiraling through the plane of inertia on those magnets. And then that completely obliterates, it like completely wipes the memory of the water, which I have found, and this is, gets into the whole homeopathic, you know, side of things. And I know a lot of people are reluctant to give homeopathics its due, but there is a notion that water holds memory, and yeah, it imprints, it gets imprinted very easily. And I have found that to be true in my life, is that water that's exposed to tons of pollutants, even if you chemically scrub the pollutants from the water, there's still an energetic residue that's in the water that will affect you.
Yeah.
Whereas with this water, there's zero residue. There's zero pollutants and there's zero residue. So it really opens you up to the broader spectrum of thinking.
And this scrubbing of the residue, the energetic residue, is essentially with these magnets then.
Yes. Yeah, that's where the magnets shine.
Magnets through some sort of vortex.
Yeah, I vortex the water around these extremely strong magnets. I mean, that magnet array I have is, it's about $150 worth of magnets.
Got it.
They're very, very strong.
So what happens after that? It goes into another tank?
That's dripping in a vessel that's always open. So Victor Schauberger, he said water is alive, especially healthy water is alive. And he said, when you finally get to the point of actually wanting to put water inside your body or give it to your plants or animals, you want it to be in open vessels. And so I have that water continually spiraling through one vessel and it's dropping into an open vessel.
Open to the air?
Yes.
And that's like outside your house or inside your house?
No, I have it set up right in my kitchen.
So I see the water comes out of the magnet spiral and into an open ceramic?
Yeah, right by my sink. It takes next to no space.
Got it.
Yeah.
What's the temperature of the water when it comes out of there?
It's not at the anomaly point. It's probably, I would say, high 60s, low 70s.
Got it. So it's warm.
We live in a temperate area. Like right now, our rainy season just started, so the temperature might drop by 5 degrees. But overall, we're in the low 80s all the time here.
Yeah. So the water into the open vessel is sort of a continuous drip into that.
Exactly. Vessel. Yeah. In my previous iterations, I was making the mistake because I was accelerating the water to over 1,000,000 RPMs. And I was heat degrading the water and I was trying to do all these like really, really like crazy energy intensive things to like really supercharge the water. And then in studying Kenneth Wheeler's work, I came to find that his way was the better way. And so now it's a very, very slow spiral, but through much stronger magnets.
Got it. And anything you want to say about what you've noticed about that water?
Well, the number one thing that I notice is that my body, like when I grew up dehydrated, because like I said, I grew up in South Florida, so I never drank water. So my body was always in this constant pain state. But because it was always like that, I didn't know any difference. And right. Also, I was kind of stupid. Like I couldn't really think full thoughts. Like I always knew I had potential. Like I always knew I could kind of like game the system and figure shit out. Oh, sorry.
It's okay.
I could figure things out.
It's fine.
But I didn't. I also had enough self-awareness to know that something wasn't fully clicking and it was extremely frustrating. And after about a year of playing with all these different water devices and living in Costa Rica and actually having water on my skin that didn't have chlorine on it, I believe my pineal gland popped. Like I hear that's what people say. Like I felt a pop one day in the middle of my head and like I could think. Like I could fully think. I could have like a paragraph in my mind, full form thought, and not have any problem with it. And I've noticed the converse too, because in all my travels around the world where I haven't had the chance to drink the good quality water that I have here, in about 2 to 3 weeks, my brain starts to slow down again. Like I start to go back into that befuddled, fragmentary way of seeing the world. I directly associate it to the water.
Got it. And what, where does your bathing water come from? What do you do about that?
It's the same.
Same water.
It's the same water. Same water.
So that goes through even some sort of water heating system.
Oh, yes. Well, I do have an on-demand hot water heater, but then also I've devised, so in one of my ovens, this is like one of my mad inventions. I created a thermosiphon, which is, I have over 35 feet of copper that's in a huge spiral. And it's in what Tesla would call a pancake coil. So I made a pancake coil on the top of one of these units that I'm telling you about with the rocket retort. So I have this rocket oven that feeds the heat to my kitchen oven. And then the top of that, I have this massive copper pancake coil that spiralizes the water through that and then dumps into my bathtub.
Got it. So that's your bathing water.
That is my, and I have to tell you, my wife will attest, like, I love my baths. Like, that's.
Yeah, I've come to realize that even the water we shower and bathe with may be as important as the water we drink.
Well, here's the thing, too. So this is, you'll laugh at this. So my only real profession I've had in the world is as a massage therapist. And I always noticed in Florida, whenever the European climate, the clients would come in during the winter time, I would massage them. And I'm like, your guy's skin is amazing. And I would be massaging, you know, people from Austria or from Sweden. And I was like, how do you have such perfect skin? And this was before I was ever exposed to Schauberger or anything about water purification, even really having the consciousness of knowing how bad the water was in Florida. And it all became apparent to me, like all of the people that I know that are from South Florida have tons of moles all over their body, have all these like demarcations on their skin, their hair doesn't look right. It's like, it's really gross, or they'll lose their hair. Like men that like, you know, shower a lot, they lose all their hair. And I have to say, like, I haven't gotten a new, I'm 15 years older now since moving here, and I haven't gotten any new moles since moving here in the good water. And we've done experiments. I actually have clients that will actually take some of the water, especially the really, because I have other ways of charging water. And they'll take it and they'll say that they'll put it on a mole, or they'll put it on a growth, like a skin tag or something like that. It diminishes it. Like it goes away.
Yeah.
And so I really believe the water that touches your skin is like just as important as what you imbibe.
Yeah. What were the Europeans doing, do you think, that made them have better skin?
Well, over there, they ate real fats. I think the number one thing was, especially my Norwegian clients, when I would listen to them about what they ate like lots of real fatty fishes. They ate lots of really stinky cheese. They always drank wines and things like that that didn't have sulfites in them.
Yeah.
And sulfates. And they were in water. They would do these terramars where they would go from hot to cold, hot to cold, hot to cold.
Yeah.
And but it was all mineral baths.
Yeah.
And like it showed in their skin. Like, and I was dealing with, you know, near geriatric age. I was dealing with people in their mid 60s and older, and their skin was incredible.
Yeah. So they were actually probably soaking in and drinking mineral baths too.
Pretty much, yes. Yeah.
All right, so that's the water. So you talked also about self-sufficiency or getting into sort of the sovereignty movement or what
yeah, that was
That
was a complete byproduct of moving here, because like when I moved here, I was more into being a vegetarian. Like that was as far as my mind went with like eating right.
Yeah.
And then it was kind of cool. The farm that I ended up living on, they were very big into Joe Salatin's work, and they were showing me, you know, Sally Fallon's work and Nourishing Traditions. And I had gotten really fat. As a vegetarian, I had gotten up to like 235 pounds. And it made no sense to me because I'm only 5'9". And I was like, I'm eating everything I should be eating, like, you know, the soy boy thing. And I look terrible. I feel stupid. Like none of it works. And so they introduced me to the Sally Fallon's work and then Weston A. Price. And I devoured that work. And I was like, oh my God, I've been looking at this totally incorrectly. You know, like the animal is actually, you know, the poop is the key. Like, you know, animal poo is soil fertility. And so I decided from a moral perspective, I wouldn't eat anything that I wasn't willing to kill myself. So when I took my toes out of the vegetarian water, I killed my first chicken and then ate my first organic chicken, and then I ate my first organic rabbit, and then I ate my first organic lamb, and my body just completely revitalized. Like I like came back to myself. And then combining that with the water that I was drinking, I was like, you know, everybody is, I felt that what was occurring for me in my young life was I was so deficient in so many things that it was a physical problem that was showing up in the psychological sphere.
Yeah.
But nobody in Western science talks about that.
Right.
Like I was deficient in so many different ways. I was dehydrated. I wasn't getting the minerals I needed. I was following these social constructs that were not additive to my being. And then when I came here, just by happenstance, I was around all these healthy people that were eating whole fats and like real things and weren't afraid of killing animals. And like, it completely flipped the script for me. And so a good friend of mine and her husband, Melissa Sweet and her husband, they started a company called Vita Authentica here, which ended up becoming the area's like largest organic co-op to like aggregate and pull in and create a market for all the local organic producers so that they would have a way of distributing what they were creating. And it's been a smashing success.
And so do you grow things for them? Is your farm participating in that?
Right now I'm way too busy with building.
Like,
uh-huh. So I have a tree farm. My family's original name out of Germany was Baumgartner. Like we're tree gardeners. And like, I find that it's actually really what I really enjoy. Like my farm has it has a lot of different tropical fruit trees.
Yeah.
We probably have an orchard of over 200 different fruit trees.
Wow.
So that's what I have time to manage. When I wasn't so busy building, and when we didn't have a baby and all that, I was much more into my own personal garden. And I look forward to getting back to that. But now pretty much all the biochar that I'm producing is either going to water conditioning, and or I use it as top cover for my orchard.
Got it. So let's say there was somebody like in New York or Kansas, and they said, I've heard this guy and I want my water system like that. How do they do that? What can they do? Can they contact you, or can you help design it? Is there a way to actually make this into a system for a person in New York or like, you know, maybe rural place?
It all depends what their supply is, right? So like if you're in an urban setting, like I really love the urban permaculture movement. There are units that are made in Austria from a company called EWO that you can actually hook up a unit that will spiralize your water. I forget at what PSI, but it will actually vortex the water around a vial of like the purest water in the world. And that has a really nice vitalizing effect. When it comes to the difference between scrubbing your water with biochar and scrubbing your water with regular carbon, I think they're worlds apart. Like if you put charcoal out with your plants, it will help a little bit. You put biochar out with your plants, it's a totally different qualitative effect with the plants. And I feel it's the same thing with the water. I think very soon, Tom, in the future, people are going to catch on to making home units out of biochar instead of just regular carbon. Because there's so many scrubbers that are sold on the market that are carbon or they're a combination of plastic and carbon.
Yeah.
I think in the very near future, there'll be somebody that comes up with the biochar units.
How often do you change the biochar?
My current system I've had running for about 2 years. You don't really need to change it.
Yeah, so it just lasts forever. Or
now, like, so they say that the half life of biochar is 40 years.
Yeah.
And so I'm the second building off of a spring. So it's not like I'm really the water isn't going through that much muckety muck here.
Yeah, got it. And is it true that you have a company that actually sells or distributes biochar or any of these other things that you're talking about?
Yeah, I have a dome making company where we also make all different types of these rocket retorts.
Uh-huh.
For our local area, like we're not at the level of, you know, distributing worldwide yet or anything like that. But we've been making, like when you start building, like there's a lot of people that move to Costa Rica for food sovereignty. So you have a lot of people that come down here like I did, you know, back in the day. And they're like, I have all this land. I have water on my property. How do we ensure that this is going to be excellent for the future? And so we've been much more local in that affair. Like we've been helping local farms institute their systems.
Got it. So their water purification system and these dome living structures that actually also protect against EMFs and probably, I'm sure it's...
Oh, so here's the coolest thing too. So just by happenstance, I had no idea that biochar did this, but biochar is like the world's best EMF remediator also. And so it makes sense why the plants love biochar so much too, because now all the power companies, they use the ground as the return on the electrical frequency pathways, right?
Right. Yeah.
So back in the day when it was very easy to find ground and have it be neutral. Now, if you live in an area where, let's say you have 100 neighbors, you have so many frequencies that are being broadcast through the ground. This was something Tesla talked about all the time. He said the world's best antenna was the ground. You know, people think of arrays as like, you know, these high spires are like the best antennas. He was like, no, the ground is the best antenna.
Right. Yeah.
So I think one of the reasons why the plants react so well to the biochar is now you've separated any of that excess charge that's in the ground from touching the roots.
Got it. Yeah. So I'm sure you use biochar in your gardens.
Yes. Yes, I do.
Can you give us I use, you know, one cup per square meter, or is there any guidelines for people for that?
Oh, I am so on the low scale compared to the nuts that I'm dealing with. Like, I have a new client, like, he literally wants to produce, like, I can't produce enough for him. He's doing a commercial nursery where he's growing like durians and like all the world's top most expensive fruit. He wants to make 3,000 meters of biochar a year. He's literally of the mind, like, you cannot have enough of this. Like, he's like, he wants it top under. He's like, cover everything, like, cover it.
No soil, just biochar.
He's, and the thing is, like, he's producing fruit from non-grafted trees in 4 years, where it would normally take 9 years, seven wow. to 9 years. So he's sold, like, in the way his things are growing, like, he spares no expense for anything. And so he has multiple inputs that are qualitative. But in his mind, the number one thing is biochar.
So are you now of the opinion that you can't put too much biochar on your land?
I'm of that opinion. I just don't have the time to make it all.
Yeah, but if you had the time, you can't imagine putting too much on.
No, you cannot overdo it.
Is there anything else that you would say to put on somebody's garden?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, we make this thing called mountain microorganisms. In other places of the world, they call it effective microorganisms. But you essentially make a ferment of like a probiotic culture. And depending on what you're trying to do with the plant, there's different recipes. And then you mix that with rock powder. And then the rock powder has all the mother minerals. And then you also mix that with magnetite, which has all the mother metals.
Yeah.
So when you have all the mother minerals, all the mother metals, and then you have these microorganisms that once again, on probably on like the homeopathic dosage level, will give the plants what they need. Everything is healthy.
Yeah.
And so to give you an example, here in the tropics, we have these leaf cutter ants. So the leaf cutter ants will attack any tree or any plant that's unhealthy. And so for years and years, when I wasn't giving my trees the biochar, the leaf cutter ants would come in and eat my trees to the bone, right? Since the last 3 years of really being steady with the biochar, the leaf cutter ants aren't around.
Yeah. Right. Insects don't attack healthy plants, basically.
Yeah. And if you have a leaf, and I have leaf cutter. Now, this is the thing. My neighbors have leaf cutter ants.
Yeah.
I'm watching the trails of them, but they're not coming onto my property.
Got it. So this probiotic stuff, is this something that you sell or that people can get? Or is this something that they have to make?
No, it's something that it's best if you make it. And the reason why we call it MAMA here is because we take the fungus that's from our local farm and we use the fungus as one of the catalysts in the actual ferment. So you would go down, you'd find, you know, an area where a forested area on your property where there was a little bit of white fungus under the leaves or something.
Yeah.
And you'd only take a handful of that. And then you'd bring it in, and then you would take a vat of molasses and dilute that with water. And then we would take some other type of carbohydrate, like I forget what it's called when they are milling corn, but you end up like with this starchy material, you put that in there, and then you put your magnetite, you put your rock powder, and then you mix all that up and you let it ferment for 1 month. And when you come back, it has this like really robust smell.
Do you stir it in that month or just leave it alone?
Yeah, the biodynamic people, they're out there, you know, vortexing it, you know, like a cauldron. I don't really have time to do that. I figure all the vortex water I'm already putting into it is good enough. It's one of those set it and forget it things for me. But I back in the day when I didn't have a job, I was definitely vortexing, you know, manually.
Got it.
But yeah, the more you can vortex anything, I think the better it is.
Yeah.
But that stuff really works. Like the plants don't get the fungus. They don't get any, well, some of them still get blight. Like I have to admit, I'm not like a real gardener. Like I'm not like, I don't know all the names of the different mites. I don't know the names of all the different, you know, tobacco mosaic virus or whatever is hitting the plant. I look at things like, oh, this plant looks sick. I give it something and now the plant is better. Yeah. That's like the extent of my knowledge.
Got it. All right. We're about out of time here. Is there anything else you would like to share with people? Any things they can do? Any places to get anything? Any place to look at for more about your work? We'd love to hear that.
Right now, I have a lot of posts on Instagram. BioCharisma. I'm BioCharisma on Instagram, so that's where I have the most. And right now, I'm making a website, and I'm actually gonna start putting plans, I think, on Shopify for my biochar retorts.
Yeah,
that's where people get they're really like totally. I get inundated with so many messages about how to make biochar.
Right.
So I think the rocket retort, as I call it, is really going to be where people on a personal level can make it for themselves.
Got it. All right. Anything else we should know about?
Well, I would say eat as organic as possible. I think I've seen all of your podcasts. Have you had a chance to talk with Dr. Stephanie Seneff?
Yes, we did.
That woman blows my mind. Every time I hear her, I have to re-listen and re-listen and re-listen.
So at
some point, I would really like to talk to her because I have some ideas about what's happening with water because she's really big now. She's starting to understand the whole thing with proteome and cellular uptake.
Yeah.
And I would say for those of you out there who haven't listened to Dr. Seneff, that she's mind-blowing.
Good. I can put you two in touch if you want.
I would love to talk to her because I know she's out.
I will make that happen.
Thank you so much. I can't wait to nerd out with her.
Okay, Christopher, I enjoyed this. I learned a lot. And all the best. Keep in touch.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Okay, you take care.
See you soon.
Bye-bye.